Good morning. It's 9 o'clock. It's a very stormy day outside, so probably have a few people coming in late, but we might as well go ahead and get started on time. There is a handout. If you didn't get one, they're on the back tables there, which I think you might find helpful for today's class as we work through the very difficult chapter 9 of Zechariah. As we talked about last week, we're just starting with chapter 9, and those last six chapters of Zechariah are some of the most difficult in the Bible. But I think if we stick to our interpretive rules and remember the context, we won't have any trouble navigating through those chapters. So we'll be starting in a moment in the first verse of chapter 9, which is where we left off last week. Let me remind everyone that the audio copies of these classes, as well as handouts such as the one we have today, are available on the internet at www.revelation.study, revelation.study. And eventually, when the class is over, the notes will be posted there as well. Let's begin our class with a prayer. Our dear Father in heaven, we're thankful for this another day of opportunity that you've given us, Father. An opportunity to meet together and have fellowship with one another and to study your word, Father, and to worship you. We're thankful for all of those wonderful opportunities you present us. Father, we're thankful for your word and our prayers that we will always study it diligently and prayerfully and carefully, Father, and to find what you have in there to say to us, Father. And we know you've been working on our behalf since before the foundation of this world, and we see your hand and your plan on every page of the Bible, Father, and we're thankful for that and for your word of truth that you've given us. Father, we're mindful of those who are traveling in this weather, and we pray they will be safe and they will be here safely, Father. And we pray all these things in Jesus' name. Amen. So when we ended last week, we were looking at verse 1 of chapter 9, and we'd started talking about it. But let me begin this week by once again reading verse 1 of chapter 9 of Zechariah. The burden of the word of the Lord in the land of Hadrach. And Damascus shall be the rest thereof, when the eyes of man, as of all the tribes of Israel, shall be toward the Lord. Well, last week we asked, what is Hadrach? And we had first considered the possibility that either Hadrach was some city in Syria that had not yet been discovered, or perhaps was some other city called Hatarika, which is mentioned in Assyrian inscriptions. But we had a problem with that view, and the main problem was, why would God give such a long pronouncement against some obscure Syrian city that is nowhere else mentioned anywhere in the Bible? That just seems kind of odd. Also, you'll note the verse refers not just to Hadrach, but to the land of Hadrach, which once again, to me, sounds less like a city and more like a region or perhaps a nation. Well, when we ended last week, then, we were looking for a better explanation for what Hadrach is, and fortunately, there is a better explanation, one that I think makes a lot more sense with the context here. I think it's very possible that Hadrach is not the literal name of any city or nation, but instead is a figurative name. Now, before we consider what the name might depict as a figure, let's ask another question. Are such figurative names used anywhere else in the Bible? And the answer is yes, they are. Isaiah 21, verse 11, for example, talks about the burden of Duma, D-U-M-A-H. Well, that's referring to Edom. By the name Duma, the name Duma means silence. So God is making a point by referring to Edom by the name Duma. Jeremiah 25, 26. And the king of Shishak shall drink after them. And then a little later in Jeremiah, Jeremiah 51, 41, how is Shishak taken? Well, Shishak is referring to Babylon, and the word Shishak means humiliation. So in fact, God is referring to Babylon by a different name, the name humiliation, again to make a point about Babylon. Isaiah 29, verse 1, woe to Ariel, the city where David dwelt. Well, Ariel there is being used as a name for Jerusalem, and Ariel means the hearth of God. So again, God is making a point by referring to Jerusalem or to Edom or to Babylon by some other name. And we see that done with people as well as with cities and nations. The book of Jeremiah, for example, gives Pharaoh Necho one of the greatest nicknames in history. In Jeremiah 46, verse 17, we read, "Call the name of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, noisy one who lets the hour go by." I like the Living Bible paraphrase of that verse. "Call him the man with no power, but with plenty of noise." In the original languages, in fact, that name was a pun, because in the original language it sounded like the Egyptian name for Pharaoh. So God was making a pun at Pharaoh's expense there in Jeremiah 46. There's another example in Jeremiah 20. Jeremiah 20, verse 3. "And it came to pass on the morrow that Pashur brought forth Jeremiah out of the stocks. Then said Jeremiah unto him, The Lord hath not called thy name Pashur, but Magar-Missabib." He got renamed too. Pashur was the priest who ordered Jeremiah to be beaten and placed in stocks. And when Jeremiah got out of the stocks, he gave Pashur a new name. That Magar-Missabib means terror all around. Terror all around. And that's exactly what Judah was going to experience if they listened to Pashur when Babylon showed up. And that's exactly what they did experience. So if we determine here that Hadrach in Zechariah 9 verse 1 is a figurative name for someone, possibly a divinely inspired insult, so to speak, then it would not be the only one in the Bible. We've seen them plenty of times. So what could Hadrach mean, and to what could it refer? And the best starting point there is to figure out, well, what does the word mean? What does Hadrach mean? Well, that's a difficulty. Some commentaries say, oh, it's a derivation from one of Syria's false gods, which was Chadrach, and they made it into Hadrach. I don't think that's the answer. The first half of Hadrach, had, means sharp, sharp. The second half of Hadrach, rak, means soft, sharp, soft. That's what Hadrach means, sharp, soft. So I think what this oracle in Zechariah 9 is directed to is the land of sharp, soft. All right, well, now we've got another problem. What does that mean? What does sharp, soft mean? Before we talk about what it means, let me say one more thing on why I think that's the best view here. For starters, there is no city called Hadrach. It's not been dug up. Now, it could be dug up tomorrow. If it is, I'll go back and maybe reconsider my position, but it has not been dug up. There's no city of Hadrach, not in the Bible, not in secular history, nowhere. So, I think that's the best reason to take this symbolically. Another good reason to take it symbolically is that it is the ancient view. The Jews have long taken this term to be figurative. And in fact, I think they're right in taking it figuratively. Where they're wrong is what they apply it to. The Jews have applied Hadrach to the Messiah, who they say would be harsh or sharp to the Gentiles, but soft or gentle to the Jews. Hadrach is not the Messiah. But I think they're onto something in their figurative understanding of Hadrach. And the fact that that's the ancient view, I think, supports our view today. Why? Well, if it's the ancient view, that means they also did not know of any city named Hadrach, right? Because they came up with a figurative meaning. If they'd had a city named Hadrach down the street, they probably would have said, well, that's what it's talking about. They also did not know of a city named Hadrach. So I think we're looking at a figurative name here. Well, so what does it mean? What nation had a sharp side and a soft side? And what nation would we expect to see here in this oracle? At this time, at this place, in the book of Zechariah? Well, the answer to both of those questions is the same. Persia. Persia. Persia had a divided character. Militarily, economically, it was very strong, but it was famous for its moral weakness. We've already seen in our study of Daniel a prophecy of Rome that made a very similar point. Remember the giant statue in Daniel chapter 2? Remember the feet made part of iron and part of clay? In other words, the feet made of clay? That was speaking of Rome, and it was talking about Rome's strength and its weakness. And in fact, when we get to the book of Revelation, we'll see a very similar point made about Rome. Well, the nation in view here is not Rome, it's Persia. But I think the same point is being made, that Persia also had a strong side, undeniably strong side, but it had a very weak side as well. This oracle from God is directed against Persia, and I think that makes perfect sense from the context here, because Persia at this time was the very power that was lording it over God's people. Those who were with us in our study of Daniel, and if you go to the website, revelation.study, you can click through a link and go right to all the audio and notes on Daniel if you missed that study. But you'll remember from that study that we talked about Medo-Persia. In fact, that was the second great nation that was prophesied in the book of Daniel, the first being Babylon, the second being Medo-Persia, and the final two being Greece and Rome. In that study, we went into some detail about the history of Medo-Persia, which I won't repeat all of that here today. But the Medo-Persians overthrew Babylon in Daniel chapter 5. That's the night, the famous night of the handwriting on the wall, when Belshazzar saw the handwriting on the wall and did not live to see much else. That combined nation of Medo-Persia was then described in Daniel 8, verse 3. Then I lifted up mine eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. We talked about that when we studied Daniel, and how that was a perfect description of Medo-Persia. The Medes used to be the dominant partner in that combined nation, but they were very quickly supplanted by the Persians. And by the time of Zechariah, really all you've got left are Persians. The Medes have been totally absorbed into the Persian Empire. So perhaps that's the sharp and soft side, the Medes and the Persians. I'm not a big fan of that view, but that's a possibility. Another possibility is that the Medes aren't really in view here at all. And remember, they'd already been kind of subsumed into the Persians. You're just hearing about Persia. You're not hearing about Medo-Persia at this time. And so perhaps the sharp and soft description is referring just to Persia, with the sharp description being the conquering side of Persia, the Persia that gave rise to leaders such as Cyrus, but also to the softness of Persia, because they would be defeated at the hands of the Greeks. So obviously they were not as strong as they thought they were. Another commentary gave yet another possible meaning for the softness of Persia. Here's what he wrote. Persia was at the same time characterized by an effeminate softness that later made Persian debauchery and effeminacy a byword and a source of the moral contamination of Greece and Rome. So that's another possibility for the soft side of Persia. Whatever the explanation, I think the best view here is to take Hadrach, the land of sharp soft, to be a figurative name for Persia. And as we proceed through the rest of chapter 9, we're going to see it fits like a glove, fits perfectly with what we're going to see in chapter 9. That leaves us with one more question, at least, and that is, why does the text use a figurative name? Why not just name Persia? Why call it Hadrach? Well, there are at least two possible answers to that question. First, God may have wanted to use this name Hadrach to make a point. We saw him doing that earlier with Babylon, with Edom, with his own people, with Pharaoh Necho. So he may have wanted to make the same kind of point here, that Persia had two sides to it. You may think it's all sharp, but no, it's got a soft side. So maybe that's why God used this term. Another possible reason is to think about the context here. The Jews were at this very time surrounded by neighbors who would love nothing more than to have in writing something that showed the Jews were traitors to Persia. So this may have also been a way to protect them from those reports back to their neighbors. And it's possible that both of those reasons are correct. We don't have to choose one of them over the other. And I think probably both of those played into why we see Hadrach here instead of Persia mentioned by name. Well, what about the rest of verse 1? And Damascus shall be the rest thereof, when the eyes of man, as of all the tribes of Israel, shall be toward the Lord. Well, as we said last week, Damascus was a major city in Syria. And so verse 1 is telling us that this judgment against Persia would begin in Syria, that this judgment that's being described here starts in Syria. That's what it means when it says the burden would rest upon Damascus. It would first rest upon Damascus. That's the starting point. Well, what is that burden? What is it that first started with Damascus? Let's hold off on that question until we get a little more evidence. Let's keep reading and we'll circle back to that question when we have some more evidence. The final phrase in verse 1 is difficult. We're going to see a lot of difficult phrases and verses in these final six chapters. Here's one. When the eyes of man, as of all the tribes of Israel, shall be toward the Lord. Some say that means that God sees all the evil that these nations have inflicted on his people. Others say, no, it means all of these people will someday recognize God. I think the best view is the simplest view. What we're seeing in these verses is a judgment by God against Persia. That's what we're about to see in chapter 9. And I think the end of verse 1 is simply saying that all of these people who would be watching that would see the mighty force that God would send. And when they saw that, they would in effect be seeing God coming down upon Persia, because of course God was behind this judgment. So I think that's what verse 1 is telling us. Verse 2. And Hamath also shall border thereby, Tyrus and Zidon, though it be very wise. And Tyrus did build herself a stronghold, and heaped up silver as the dust, and fine gold as the mire of the streets. Behold, the Lord will cast her out, and he will smite her power in the sea, and she shall be devoured with fire. Well, the beginning of verse 2 really should have been stuck on the end of verse 1, because Hamath is another city in Syria, and it would be judged along with Damascus. With the second half of verse 2, what we see is that there'll also be a judgment against Tyre and Sidon. The focus of the verses that follow is on the fall of Tyre. We really don't see much about Sidon other than it's mentioned here. Which raises a question. Why is Sidon mentioned if the focus is on Tyre? And I think the answer to that may depend upon another symbol, the symbolic number 4, which we know represents the earth or the powers of the earth. Notice how many cities we've seen so far. We've seen 4 cities so far. Also, in the next set of verses, we're going to see the cities of Philistia. How many well-known cities of Philistia were there? There were 5. How many are we going to see in the next few verses? 4. Only 4. We've seen 4 cities so far. We're about to see another 4 cities. I think the reason we're seeing 4 and 4 is because of the symbolic meaning of the number 4. Chapter 9 is giving us the judgment of God against these earthly powers. That's why we keep seeing the number 4 here. And we've certainly seen the number 4 a lot in our study of Zechariah. If that is correct, then that's another reason to take Hadrach to be symbolic for Persia, and rather than a city. Because if Hadrach were a city, that means we would have seen 5 cities so far, which would really make me wonder why God left out the 5th Philistine city. So I think we've seen 4 cities so far, and we're about to see another 4 when we get to the following verses. Now, Tyre was known in the ancient world for its worldly wisdom. And verse 2 tells us that its worldly wisdom is not going to save it. In fact, nothing that Tyre could do would be enough to save it from the judgment that was going to come its way. Even if Tyre built a large stronghold, it would not be enough. Even if they pulled out all their silver and their gold and heaped it up together, the verse tells us that would not be enough. They could not bribe themselves out of this danger. Whatever was coming Tyre's way would be very different from anything that had come against it before. And the city had been besieged before. They were besieged by the Assyrians for 5 years. They were besieged by the Babylonians for 13 years. But this time, things would be very, very different. They would fall, and they would certainly fall quickly compared with those other sieges. Well, what was coming? Again, let's hold off on that till we get a little more evidence. One thing we can say for sure is that the fall of Tyre would be a shocking event. That's what verse 4 tells us. Behold, the Lord will cast her out. And that verse also confirms that God is behind this judgment. This is not just something that's going to happen to Tyre. This is something that God is sending to happen to Tyre. The great commercial city of Tyre would fall at the hands of a great conqueror sent by God. Verse 5. Ashkelon shall see it and fear. Gaza also shall see it and be very sorrowful. And Ekron, for her expectation, shall be ashamed. And the king shall perish from Gaza, and Ashkelon shall not be inhabited. And a bastard shall dwell in Ashdod, and I will cut off the pride of the Philistines. Well, the Philistines are next in line for this coming judgment against the Persian Empire. Four Philistine cities are mentioned here: Ashkelon, Gaza, Ekron, and Ashdod. The fifth one is not mentioned here, that's Gath. And again, we just talked about why only four of them are mentioned. Ashkelon would fear for its own safety. Why? Well, because it just saw what happened to Tyre. That's why it's going to fear for its own safety. If that could happen to Tyre, what's going to happen to us? Ashkelon, we're told, would no longer be inhabited. Gaza and Ekron would see what happened to Tyre, and they would be very sorrowful because they also would know they didn't stand a chance. If the great city of Tyre fell, then what hope did they have? Ekron's trust in Tyre would be put to shame, is what that verse is telling us, and Gaza's king would perish. Verse 6 tells us a bastard would dwell in Ashdod. Well, what does that mean? Well, it could mean that the city would be ruled by someone born of incest or adultery, but it could just mean that the city would be ruled by a foreigner or a stranger. Either way, the message is clear. Ashdod would be humiliated. These four great cities were the pride of the Philistines, and when they fell, the pride of the Philistines was cut off. That's what verse 6 tells us. So who was this great conqueror sent from God? When and how was this prophecy fulfilled? Well, we're finally in a position to answer that question. We've seen enough evidence to know the answer to that question. Well, what have we seen? What we've seen is that a great force from God would start with Damascus, move to Tyre, and then move against the cities of Philistia. When did that happen? Who was that great conqueror sent by God to judge these nations? Well, let's listen as Wikipedia answers that question. And I haven't pulled up some religious article on Wikipedia. I'm just going to read you some history, and you can read it in any book of history. I just pulled it up on Wikipedia because I was typing away on the web when I got to this point. But you could find this in any historical book. And as I read this description from this online encyclopedia, you might look at the handout. At the top of the handout, you see a mosaic of Alexander the Great. And at the bottom, you see a map of his conquest. Here's what the encyclopedia says. As I read this, think about what we've just read in Zechariah chapter 9. And I also want you to think about this. What I'm about to read to you from the encyclopedia happened 200 years after Zechariah 9 was given by God to his people. In spring 333 BC, Alexander the Great crossed to Taurus in Cilicia. After a long pause due to illness, he marched on towards Syria. Though outmaneuvered by Darius's significantly larger army, he marched back to Cilicia, where he defeated Darius at Issus. Now, if you look at your map, you'll see Issus, right, kind of right here. It says Issus 333 BC. That's that battle I just read to you there. Darius fled the battle, causing his army to collapse, and left behind his wife, his two daughters, his mother, and a fabulous treasure. Alexander proceeded to take possession of Syria and most of the coast. In the following year, 332 BC, he was forced to attack Tyre, which he captured after a long and difficult siege. Long there, though, was about 9 months, so it's much, much shorter than those other sieges I mentioned earlier. And as you look down the map, you'll see there's another battle right there at Tyre. The men of military age were massacred and the women and children sold into slavery. When Alexander destroyed Tyre, most of the towns on the route to Egypt quickly capitulated. However, Alexander met with resistance at Gaza. The stronghold was heavily fortified and built on a hill, requiring a siege. When his engineers pointed out to him that because of the height of the mound, it would be impossible, this encouraged Alexander all the more to make the attempt. After three unsuccessful assaults, the stronghold fell, but not before Alexander had received a serious shoulder wound. As in Tyre, men of military age were put to the sword, and the women and children were sold into slavery. Syria, then Tyre, then Philistia. Where have we seen that? Zechariah chapter 9, same exact order, the same order. Another article online sheds a little more light on the siege of Tyre. The siege of Tyre was orchestrated by Alexander the Great in 332 BC during his campaigns against the Persians. The Macedonian army was unable to capture the city, which was a strategic coastal base on the Mediterranean Sea, through conventional means because it was on an island and had walls right up to the sea. Alexander responded to this problem by first blockading and besieging Tyre for 7 months. That had never worked. He tried it for 7 months. And then he succeeded by building a causeway that allowed him to breach the fortifications. It is said that Alexander was so enraged at the Tyrians' defense of their city and the loss of his men that he destroyed half of that city. Where have we seen this great assault on the seemingly impregnable city of Tyre? Right here in Zechariah chapter 9. 200 years before that happened. This prophecy in the opening verses of Zechariah 9 is describing these very events that I just read to you. They were also prophesied even earlier in Daniel. Daniel 2 verse 39. And after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth. The kingdom at the time of that prophecy was Babylon. The inferior kingdom that would arise after was Persia. And the kingdom of brass, Greece. Alexander the Great coming down upon Persia, prophesied by Daniel in Daniel 2:39. And we're seeing a detailed prophecy of that in Zechariah 9. And these prophecies, with this great detail, were given 200 years earlier than the events themselves. Here's how one commentary described it. The astonishing accuracy of these prophecies points to the invasion down this very route by the famous Macedonian conqueror, Alexander the Great. In the year 333 BC, Alexander won a great victory over the Persians at Issus. Instead of pursuing his enemy into the Persian interior, which would expose his line of supply to the powerful Persian navy in the Mediterranean Sea, Alexander brilliantly turned south to roll up the Persian cities along the coast. His strategy was to eliminate the enemy navy by removing its ports, marching through Phoenicia and Philistia down to Egypt, only then returning north to deal with Persia. Look at your map. Here's the Battle of Issus right here. Here's Persia over here. Anybody would have thought, okay, you have his daughter, his granddaughter, his wife, all his treasure, just keep on marching. You're on a roll. Not Alexander. He didn't march straight into Persia. Instead, he marched down, straight down, down the coast, taking care of those port cities. What did that mean? That means he had to march back up the way he went, which means he had to pass Jerusalem twice. Keep that in mind. Who would have thought he would have done that? And yet that's what he did. It was successful. And if he just picked up the book of Zechariah, written 200 years earlier, he would have seen it all described for him, as would anybody. The Persians could have read all about it. They could have known that brilliant plan if they just listened to Zechariah. Well, what about Jerusalem? Did Alexander the Great destroy Jerusalem? If not, why not? Well, we're going to see an answer to that question in verse 8. But as is so often the case, we have to deal with a very difficult verse before we get there, and that's the very difficult verse 7. So let's look at verse 7 before we get to verse 8. Verse 7, "And I will take away his blood out of his mouth, and his abominations from between his teeth. But he that remaineth, even he, shall be for our God, and he shall be as a governor in Judah, and Ekron as a Jebusite." Okay, verse 7 is one of those very difficult verses that are scattered all throughout the final six chapters of Zechariah. Here's what one commentary said about verses 1 through 7. And before I read this, let me tell you, I agree with this commentary on verses 1 through 6. I disagree with this commentary about verse 7. So let's read what he had to say. The prophecy was, no doubt, designed by God, by divine providence, as to cover the victorious progress of Alexander the Great. For the order of the towns mentioned is identical with Alexander's line of march after the Battle of Issus. So far, so good. Yet we dare not conclude that verses 1 through 7 are a prophecy of this hero's success, for verse 7 marks a result that did not follow upon his conquest. All right, this commentary just told us that verses 1 through 6 is an exact blueprint of Alexander. And then when he gets to verse 7, he says, oh, wait, but it can't be because look at verse 7. No, no, no. We're clear on what verses 1 through 6 mean. We just need to figure out how verse 7 fits into that context. Remember, one of our rules is to interpret the difficult verses in light of the more easy to understand verses. And although verses 1 through 6 are not the easiest to understand in the Bible, they're certainly a lot easier to understand than verse 7. So let's look at verse 7 in the context of what we've just seen for verse 6. Well, verse 7 starts by telling us two things that the people would stop doing. Removing his blood from his mouth. That likely refers to drinking a sacrificial blood drink during some act of false worship, or maybe even the eating of victims used in the sacrifice of false worship. Removing his abominations from between his teeth likely refers to unclean animals that were eaten during false worship, or to sacrifices that were offered to idols and then eaten. That would stop, is what we're told. The people would turn from those things, and instead, those who are left alive shall be for our God, shall be as a governor in Judah, and Ekron as a Jebusite. Okay, well, the English Standard Version there, when it says shall be for our God, says shall be a remnant for our God, which I think is a better translation there. So in fact, what we're saying here is that the remaining Philistines would become part of the remnant, part of the remnant. In fact, they would be as a governor or a chief in Israel. That is, they would have an honored position in the remnant. The last description in verse 7 is that Ekron would be as a Jebusite. Okay, well, the Jebusites were the ancient inhabitants of Jerusalem. 1 Chronicles 11 verse 4, and David and all Israel went to Jerusalem, which is Jebus, where the Jebusites were, the inhabitants of the land. So they were there first. The Jebusites were not run out of the land, though, as most of the other people were. Instead, they continued to live among the Jews in the land. Judges 1:21. And the children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites that inhabited Jerusalem, but the Jebusites dwelt with the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem unto this day. All right, well, Ekron, why is that mentioned here? Well, Ekron was the closest Philistine city to Jerusalem. So I think the point being made here is that the remaining Philistines would continue to live among the Jews. Again, I think it's the same point we just saw. They'd be part of the remnant. That's what the text is telling us here, and it's telling us that in multiple different ways. So on the surface, at least, verse 7 seems to be saying that after the Philistines were conquered by Alexander the Great, they would all the remaining ones would be converted to God. Well, that did not happen immediately after the conquest. And nowhere does verse 7 say that it would occur immediately after the conquest, so that's fine. The question is, did it ever happen? Did it ever happen? And the answer is yes, in at least two different ways that happened. During the time between the Testaments, and we've talked about that in our study of Ezra and our study of Daniel, the Maccabean rulers of Judea successfully annexed the Philistine territory. And when they did, Mosaic regulations were put into force, and they effectively became part of Judaism. That might be what verse 7 has in mind here, but I think there's a better view. And I think verse 7 is looking forward to the day when both Jew and Gentile would worship God together in the church. And we've certainly seen that over and over as a theme throughout the book of Zechariah. To see why I think that's the best view, let's stop and ask a very important question, which we should always stop and ask when we're studying difficult sections of the Bible. Why was God doing this? Why was God doing all of this? Why was God using the Greeks to destroy the Persians? And why would God later use Rome to destroy the Greeks? We know it was a detailed plan of God. We've seen it here. We've seen it in Daniel. We know that. Why was God doing it? Why? Because God was creating the perfect cradle for his son. And I'm not talking there about that manger. That perfect cradle was a world almost entirely at peace, in which the Greek language was known and used all throughout the known world. That was the perfect cradle for Jesus to come and the perfect cradle for the gospel to spread. And that is what God is doing here. That's why God is doing this. That's why we have the Greeks. That's why we have the Romans. That's why we have all this happening. He was bringing forth the perfect setting in which to bring his son into this world, to bless the entire world as had been promised to Abraham so long ago. That's why God is doing this. And it was when that blessing came that verse 7 was fulfilled. I think that's the best way to view the very difficult verse 7. God was doing all of this so that the Philistines of this world, and believe me, the Philistines haven't gone anywhere, so that the Philistines of this world could turn to him and obey the gospel and be saved. If there were no verse 7, then we'd all be left wondering why we had verses 1 through 6. But verse 7 explains why we have verses 1 through 6. So what happened to Jerusalem when Alexander marched through the area? And we know he did so twice, going and coming back. Verse 8 answers that question, and it does so 200 years before it happened. And what an incredible, incredible answer it is. Verse 8, "And I, God, will encamp about mine house because of the army, because of him that passes by, and because of him that returneth. And no oppressor shall pass through any more, for now have I seen with mine eyes." That's God speaking. Before we comment on verse 8, I want to read to you a rather lengthy section from the writings of Josephus in his book, The Antiquities of the Jews. If you were with us for our study of Jewish history, which was a Wednesday night study a year or so ago, that's also all on the internet if you weren't here for that. We had a whole lesson on Josephus, who was the great Jewish historian. Certainly not inspired, but nevertheless a very interesting Jewish historian. Now keep in mind verse 8 that I just read to you. That's God describing how he's going to deal with Jerusalem when Alexander marches by. Keep verse 8 in mind as I read to you from Josephus. "Now Alexander, when he had taken Gaza, made haste to go up to Jerusalem. And the high priest, when he heard that, was in agony and under terror, as not knowing how he should meet Alexander and his army. He therefore ordained that the people should make supplications and should join with him in offering sacrifices to God, whom he besought to protect that nation and to deliver them from the perils that were coming upon them. Whereupon God warned him in a dream, which came up on him after he had offered sacrifice, that he should take courage and adorn the city and open the gates, that the rest should appear in white garments, but that he and the priests should meet the king in their usual priestly attire, without the dread of any ill consequences, which the providence of God would prevent. Upon which, when he rose from his sleep, he greatly rejoiced, and declared to all the warning he had received from God, according to which dream he acted entirely. And so he waited for the coming of Alexander." Okay, I'm going to keep reading here in a second, but what we've seen so far from Josephus is that the high priest had a dream, and the dream said, "Alexander's coming, open the gates. And you go out there to meet him, but don't go out there dressed in white. You go out there in your usual priestly attire." That's going to be important for what we read next. Okay, Josephus continues. "And when he understood that Alexander was not far from the city, he went out in procession with the priest and the multitude of the citizens. And although the enemies of the Jews thought they would soon have liberty to plunder the city, the very reverse happened. For Alexander, when he saw the multitude at a distance in white garments, while the priest stood clothed with fine linen, and the high priest in purple and scarlet clothing, with his mitre on his head, having the golden plate on which the name of God was engraved, Alexander approached by himself and adored that name and first saluted the high priest. The Jews also did all together with one voice salute Alexander and encompassed him about. Whereupon the kings of Syria and the rest were surprised at what Alexander had done and supposed him disordered in his mind." Those are the ones marching with Alexander. "What are you doing?" they're wondering. "However, they asked him how it came to pass that when all the others adored him, he should adore the high priest of the Jews. Why are you doing this, Alexander?" To whom Alexander replied, "I did not adore him, but rather I adored God, who hath honored him with that high priesthood. For I saw this very person in his priestly clothing in a dream, who, when I was considering with myself how I might obtain the dominion of Asia, exhorted me to make no delay, but boldly to pass over the sea, for that he would conduct my army and would give me dominion over the Persians. Whence it is that having seen no other in such priestly clothing, and now seeing this person in that priestly clothing, and remembering that vision and the exhortation I had in my dream, I believe that I bring this army under divine conduct and shall therewith conquer Darius and destroy the power of the Persians, that all things will succeed according to that which is in mine own mind. And when he had said this, he gave the high priest his right hand, and the high priest ran along by him, and he came into the city. And when he went up to the temple, he offered sacrifice to God according to the high priest's direction, and magnificently treated both the high priest and the priest. Now listen to this final sentence. And when the book of Daniel was showed to him, wherein Daniel declared that one of the Greeks should destroy the empire of the Persians, he supposed that he himself was the person intended. And he was. Can you believe that? Isn't that a wonderful session from Josephus? Josephus is not inspired. We don't know if that's what happened, but doesn't that fit perfectly with verse 8? Verse 8, and I, God, will encamp about mine house because of the army, because of him that passes by, and because of him that returneth. And in fact, Josephus tells us they showed him the book of Daniel. And he says, that's me. And he was right. And he spared the city of Jerusalem. Jerusalem was not destroyed by Alexander. We know that historically from numerous historical sources. Why? Because God had encamped around that city and God protected that city from Alexander the Great. Both when Alexander marched by on his way to Egypt and when he marched back by on his way back up to Persia. You can see that in the handout. How did God protect Jerusalem from Alexander? The Bible does not provide those details. But in my opinion, Josephus does. In any event, we know that God protected Jerusalem, kept it from being destroyed, while all those other cities were being destroyed by Alexander. And we know that protection was prophesied by Zechariah 200 years before it happened, before Alexander the Great was even born. Remember in our introductory comments, we described how many commentaries see Zechariah as two books and not one book? Well, they split Zechariah right here at chapter 9. And they say, okay, we got the first part of Zechariah, which may have been written by Zechariah, but then we got all these other chapters at the end, and they're much later, and they weren't written by Zechariah. Why did they do that? We know why they do that. They do that for the same reason that they tried to do that to Daniel. Because they cannot have predictive prophecy in the Bible, and they will do anything, and they will sacrifice anything, including their own intellectual integrity, to keep predictive prophecy out of the Bible. That's why they try to move Zechariah further in time. Well, they can't do that. Zechariah is one book, and this was written 200 years before these events came to pass. The efforts of those commentators tell us much more about those commentators than they do about the Bible. I'm reminded of one of my grandfather's favorite quotes. There is no deafness so permanent as the deafness that will not hear. There is no blindness so incurable as the blindness that will not see. There is no ignorance so deep as the ignorance that will not know. The evidence is on every page of the Bible. Reminded also of Matthew 13, verse 15. For this people's heart is waxed gross, their ears are dull of hearing, their eyes they have closed, lest at any time they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears and should understand with their heart and should be converted and heal them. Their eyes are closed. And Ephesians 4, 18. Having the understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God through the ignorance that is in them because of the blindness of their heart. The evidence that this Bible is the divine word of God is on every page. Truly, it's the fool who has said in his heart, there is no God. One must be truly blind, not to see Christ and his church and the power of God in the book of Zechariah. The end of verse 8, no oppressor shall pass through them anymore, for now have I seen with mine eyes. That's also a difficult verse, and we will pick up there starting next week. This section of Zechariah, I mean, we've just started in chapter 9. We've got more to go. It has been just a truly wonderful study, and I hope you're enjoying it as well. Alexander the Great, I mean, he's called the Great for a reason, right? I mean, he did things no one had ever done before, and he was an incredible conqueror. But of course, now we know who was behind him, don't we? We know why he was called great. He had God behind him. But there was another conqueror. There was another deliverer who was coming. And we're going to see him also in chapter 9 of Zechariah. Next week, we'll pick up here where we left off. Thank you very much for your attention.